Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is one of the most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world, has written ten books. Well, how many books have you written?
Something like that.
The most recent of which is The Sun's Heartbeat, which is now available in paperback. Always nice to have Bob here. The phone number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. You can comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you can tweet your questions and comments to Bob at WAMC Vox Pop or email voxpop@wamc.org. But by all means, call 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here. Thank you.
So we have a lunar eclipse on the way.
Yeah, we do. And this is a really rare year because we're going to have two of them in a single year. One is a week from Monday.
How often does that happen?
Well, sometimes we go 3, 4, 5 years without any.
Mm-hmm.
And then when one comes, it's not necessarily visible here. It could happen during the daytime, but this one's going to be very easily seen from our area. The only problem is that it really starts around 2 in the morning.
You know, intuitively, I would think that given the geometry of the way things work, that there'd be the same number of eclipses every year.
Right, but the moon has this 5-degree tilt to its orbital axis compared to Earth going around the sun. So most of the time, at full moon, Earth's shadow misses it.
Ah, okay. And so what's the max number in a year that one could get?
Two total.
Two is the max?
Eclipses, yeah.
Okay, so it'll be a good year. Well, Bob, the phone lines are loaded. Let's go right to them. And Emily in Plainfield, Massachusetts, you're first. Hi, Emily.
Hello, Ray. Hello, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
So I know that the sun, for instance, is highest in the sky at summer, and it moves, like, furthest north, so to speak, and then come winter solstice, it's going to be lowest in the sky furthest south, and that the moon does roughly the reverse. It's higher in the winter, lower in the summer. But it seems like whereas the sun incrementally moves in one direction, hits solstice, then goes back in the other, there's more variation in the path of the moon. And I'm wondering, on a given full moon, July in this case, if I know where it like is, can be seen really clearly on a certain piece of property when it's almost full, can I count that a few days later, allowing for the fact that it's going to rise later and later, it will be in the same place, or does it kind of wander around more?
Now, that's a great question, and the reason it wanders is because the moon's orbit has a 5-degree tilt relative to our plane of orbiting the sun. So some years, the moon's position, and this is one of them, pretty much equals the sun's. So that, in other words, on the equinoxes, when the sun has a certain height in the sky, and we're talking about the full moon, by the way, because only the full moon is opposite the sun. And the new moon, which you can't see, does the same thing as the sun. The other phases can be all over the place.
So, right, so we're talking about what's always confusing.
Yeah, we're talking about the full moon. So the full moon being opposite the sun, it's going to be on the same path that the sun takes around the sky, the ecliptic, passing through the zodiac constellations. But some years, for example, 5 years ago, it had a more extreme path so that the full moon could be 5 degrees higher than the sun ever gets. That's 10 moon widths. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to its lowest point in winter, as you correctly said, in winter when the sun is lowest, that's when the full moon can get higher. The moon can get 10 full moon widths higher than the sun ever gets, and in the summertime, 10 full moon widths lower. Not this year. This year, it's pretty much equal to whatever the sun does. So back to your question about the July full moon, figure out just roughly where the sun is 6 months later. That is where the lowest sun you ever see on your property is, and that's where the full moon will be this July.
So it will be low, though.
Yes, yes, yes. Always, yes.
Okay. Thank you for that information.
Sure.
Emily, thank you for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go to Ramon in somewhere. Where are you calling?
Pine Bush.
It looked like something not Pine Bush. You're on.
All right. Now, I hope I'm understanding this correctly. The Earth didn't create water. All the water that's on the Earth was there when it was formed.
No. There's one major idea that it came here from comets, because comets are mostly water, and comets have been hitting us since forever.
Okay, so still, I think this the question still stands, if that's the case. How come the water didn't boil off if there was no atmosphere? Like right now, if you go up out of the atmosphere, am I wrong? If you have a cup of water, it'll boil off?
No, you're absolutely right. For every 550 feet higher you go, water boils off 1 degree quicker.
Sooner. So if we didn't, if the Earth didn't have a cap of atmosphere holding all this water down, how come we have this immense, incredible amount, to date, unique amount of water?
Well, that's a great question. And we could not have had water until we had an atmosphere. Just as the moon, for example, you could bring all the water you want. You could set up a nice decorative bird bath on the moon. And what would happen as soon as you put water in it, it would boil off immediately. Actually, it would freeze at the same time while it was boiling. So you'd end up with a kind of grotesque-looking modern art sculpture made of ice where it was boiling and then freezing solid in the act of boiling. So, yeah, that's what would have happened here on Earth. We had to have an atmosphere because water, as you've correctly pointed out, only exists under pressure. Liquid water can only exist under pressure. So we had to have the air. And if you live 1,000 feet above sea level, water will boil off 2 degrees quicker than it will for people down at sea level, like here in Albany or in Kingston, for example.
Okay, so the assumption is that Earth had an atmosphere.
Had to, yes.
And that would have been, do they know what that would have been?
Well, it was different from today.
I know, like Jupiter,
that's right.
A lot of atmosphere. And
that's
not,
right.
Not.
You would have had more methane and more things like that. Free oxygen is always a very, very odd thing because oxygen just loves to bond with anything. So it gets hold of carbon and you get carbon dioxide. It'll get hold of iron and then you'll get a rusty kind of things. And only when it's finished combining with everything it can find, then you can have free oxygen. Usually you can't have free oxygen because the oxygen will always find something to bond with. And so it's now believed that you've got to have life, got to have plant life to replenish free oxygen and release it. Otherwise, you're just not going to have it in your atmosphere. Huh. So we now think that as we scour the universe and search the universe, only in places that we can detect free oxygen is that a sign that that's where we'll find life.
Awesome. I'm glad there are minds working on this.
Thanks for the call, Thanks. Ramon. We appreciate it very much. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest. And let's go to Grace. Grace, you're calling from Massachusetts. Where are you calling from?
Just south of where Alan lives. I'm in Sheffield.
Oh, fair enough. Well, nice to have you on the show. You're on with Bob.
Okay. My first question is, why are the smaller planets closer to the sun? And my second question is why, when you have a rainbow, is it brighter on the inside of the rainbow?
Okay, second.
Darker on the outside and brighter on the inside.
Yes, yes, quite so. We now think that the smaller planets, there was once a thought that where the solar gravity was strongest, that was going to pull on the heavier, denser objects. And the first four planets, Mercury through Mars, are the densest planets in the solar system, Earth being the densest, wouldn't you know it, at 5.5 times the density of water. But the alternative explanation is that the planets outside of Mars are almost entirely hydrogen and helium, light gases that could easily escape. So perhaps Earth and Mercury and these planets were just the cores of originally larger things that would have had a lot more substance to them, gassy hydrogen and helium, but with the high temperatures near the sun, the first four planets, simply put, things were moving faster. Heat is just another name for moving atoms, and the escape velocity of these gases, hydrogen and helium, were easily reached. So they just, we couldn't hold on to a big, thick, fluffy planet. All we could hold on to is a small rocky planet. So that's the reason for that. Now, your second question about rainbows, you're right. Outside of the primary rainbow, every rainbow is part of a circle, and it's an arc. An arc is a section of a circle, and every circle has a center, and the center of every rainbow is the shadow of your head. So surrounding the shadow of your head, you'll get the primary rainbow 42 degrees in radius away from it, and then outside of that there's an odd dark band of sky. That's what you're talking about, where the sky is darker than on the inside. And the reason for that is that there are little droplets of water on the inside that are reflecting all the colors of light equally, and that produces a whitish color, whereas outside, that's not happening. In fact, the name for that dark band just outside the primary rainbow is Alexander's Dark Band. Sounds like a song.
Alexander's Ragtime Dark Band.
Yes, yeah. Alexander's Dark Band, named for Alexander of Aphrodisias, about 200 AD, the first ancient Greek who discovered that. That's kind of a cool fact to share with somebody on a date,
I suppose. Hey, Grace, thanks for the call. 1-800-348-2551. So quickly, Bob, the core, then you're saying all the planets beyond Mars, the gaseous planets, they all have cores then?
Yes, yeah, they probably all have tiny or small rocky cores.
How small? In other words, how big is Jupiter's core?
Nobody knows. Jupiter has 318 times the mass of Earth, so it's a huge mass of hydrogen. And the thing is, as you get lower and lower and lower, the hydrogen itself gets compressed, so it gets denser and denser and denser. So now where pure hydrogen leaves off and where any rocky materials start to exist, and no doubt they're there, nobody can say.
Okay, let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back with Bob Berman.
Support comes from Empire State Youth Orchestra and the Cathedral of All Saints, presenting a benefit concert for Northern Rivers Family Services this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Cathedral of All Saints, Albany, New York. ESYO.org. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavocandWealthStrategies.com. And Oakwood Friends School, Poughkeepsie, New York, a college preparatory boarding and day school for grades 6 through 12. Information session with faculty and students, Tuesday, April 8th at 9:30 a.m. OakwoodFriends.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. The Astronomy Show. Bob Berman is here for his appearance this month. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Jeff in Gardner. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you, Ray and Bob, both for the chance to call in.
Thank you.
I was still concerned about a conversation we had on the science forum one day when a woman called in to ask if it was really possible that on the equinox the sun would come up in the due east everywhere on the Earth.
Yeah, I remember that question. I can't remember. I think there was some dissension among the ranks as to what the actual answer was.
Well, I was surprised by the answer. I think the only scientist that had a real opinion about it was concerned that it could only be true at the equator. And that's not what I was expecting to hear. I was surprised by that. And since then, I tried to do a calculation that I think, if my high school trigonometry is correct, showed me that if I was 1,000 miles away from the equator, that would only really account for about 6/10,000ths of 1 degree of difference.
You're right, and whoever it was who said that it's only true on the equator was wrong.
Okay.
And this is the best way to think of it. On the equinox, I know you can visualize this, since our axis, our pole from pole to pole, is perpendicular to the sun, that means that the line separating day from night, the terminator of Earth, is running from pole to pole. You can picture that, right?
Yes.
Okay. And now the Earth is spinning, so that no matter where you are on our spinning Earth, you are meeting the terminator perpendicularly. Okay?
Yes.
So
yes.
Because you're meeting the terminator perpendicularly, and the terminator is the north-south line, you can visualize that you have to be heading due east as you go into the daytime line and due west when you're heading to into the nighttime part of that terminator. So, yes, all places on the Earth see the sun rise and set precisely due east and due west.
Okay. You know, I also argued this with my older brother one time. He's an engineer, and he told me, well, Jeff, it can't be true because he's been above the Arctic Circle where they have, like, sunlight for 6 months and dark for 6 months. And I told him, okay, well, I bet the sun comes up on the spring equinox, and it comes up in the due east, and it sets in the fall equinox, and it sets in the due west.
No, you're right. Now, the only caveat, since you're really bringing up like an esoteric location, is if you were on one of the poles, if you were standing on the North Pole, here's what you see instead. Now you see, theoretically, half of the sun sticking up above the horizon, half of the sun hidden below the horizon, and the sun just moving completely around the sky in a horizontal fashion, really not rising or setting. And it's just that by the next day, there's been a slight upward trend so that now the entire sun is above the horizon. But the motion is really horizontal, so you would not find a particular rising spot. Now, in practice, the atmosphere is so thick when you're looking down that low that it bends the sun's image up by half a degree, which is the sun's width. So in practice, the sun is already fully up at both poles on the day of the equinox. In other words, it looks like a rubber ball standing on the horizon, fully on the horizon, and gliding completely around the sky, moving sideways, horizontal. It's not rising up at all.
Wow. That's great. I'd love to see time-lapse photography of that. That would be something.
Thank you so much. Now my mind is at ease.
All right. Well, that makes one of us. Good. Jeff, thank you very much. Let's go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry, you're up.
Yes. Hi. Thanks, Ray. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I want to make reference to a story that came out a couple of months ago. It made the national news for a few days anyway. And it's not like I put a lot of stock into this, but I'm just wondering what there is about the universe that would make any scientists or cosmologists come out with the idea that the universe or part of the universe doesn't really exist. It's just a product of our imagination. Do you remember that story,
you've
Bob?
Done it.
No, you remember that story, Bob?
No, I didn't see the story, but I could certainly comment on that.
Okay.
What the heck would that mean, that it's only our imagination? I mean, when you look around right now, we have all of us has perception, awareness. We see things in front of us. Now, you can argue that perception is correlative with the universe. In other words, as George Berkeley said, he was the philosopher for whom the city and the campus were named, that the only things we ever perceive are our perceptions, so that all we see are our perceptions, and we only assume there's an external universe that corresponds with our perceptions, but that doesn't negate our perceptions. So to say that the universe is imaginary and doesn't exist, I couldn't even understand what that would mean or what somebody was thinking of. I mean, what could that mean? Come on.
Well, so apparently it's not an idea that's caught on very much with any...
No, of course not. The only thing, I mean, when you're talking about non-existence, is the person saying, well, it's not real except in our minds as part of our perception? But if so, that's still real. That's real as a perception. You could say it's not real in the sense that there's so much empty space between things that what we perceive that seem to be matter particles are virtually 0% of the whole thing. I mean, there's ways you could qualify that and come to that, but you can't just do a blanket, the universe doesn't exist. I don't see what that could possibly mean.
Yes, there was also a philosopher named Schopenhauer who said that the reality doesn't exist. He just said everything we see is our perception of what emanates from the mind of God. It's all God's ideas. But even in the philosophical community, that didn't really gain a lot of popularity.
No, and I liked Arthur Schopenhauer, and so did Einstein. Arthur Schopenhauer was the one that gave Einstein the line that he liked to quote the most, because Einstein did not believe in free will, and he would quote Schopenhauer, who said that a man can do as he wills, but he can't will as he wills.
Mm-hmm. So Schopenhauer had some credibility to it.
I think so, yeah, sure.
Okay, well, Jay Leno said, he made a joke just after this idea came out, and he said, see, this is what happens after, I told you this stuff would happen after marijuana was legalized.
There you go. And Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. And so we have taken a metaphysical turn. Let's go to Richard in Western Mass. Richard, you're up.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So actually, I had a original question, which I'll go to, but I did want to comment on that last speaker. What came out in the news was the theory that the universe is a hologram, not so much that it doesn't exist, but that it's it's an organization of light, and then just as you said, we organize that into our structure. So it's not that it doesn't exist at all; it's just that it's way more flexible than we like to think.
Okay.
And before you get to your other your main point, I just want to comment that our present state of cosmological knowledge, we've talked about this before, is so low that it's the data, the actual hard data we have about the universe compared to what of the things we could know. Its composition, the percentage of matter that we know about is so low that we're kind of filling in the big blanks, and they're so big with these ideas. I won't even call them theoretical ideas. Well, maybe there are multiverses, maybe it's a hologram, right. Maybe everything started from membranes, and there's virtually no support behind them, which is why a lot of physicists, when they hear stuff like this, they just roll their eyes, because a lot of physicists are from the old-fashioned school that if you're not doing observations or experiments or saying something that's falsifiable, that is, you can prove it or not prove it, then you might as well be just smoking pot and being back in the dorm room.
Well, all right.
But it is an exciting time, though, in terms of discoveries.
But what was your question?
Okay, so there was, I believe it was on Radiolab last week. They were discussing the cataclysmic event of, 65 million years ago, the meteor striking the Earth and, basically destroying all life on Earth at that point. And the reason why I thought of this question was because of the person calling about the water earlier. And so this person was saying that, this speaker on the radio show was saying that when this cataclysmic event happened, that the heat was so extreme, it was 20 times the heat of the sun, and within 2 hours would have vaporized all life on Earth. So my question is, how did you get all the water back?
Well, it didn't kill all the life on Earth.
No. If you're talking about the KT event, that is the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction event 65 million years ago, it didn't even destroy one quarter of the genera on Earth. Yeah, famously, it did away with the dinosaurs, but it was not. It was nothing like the Permian Great Dying of 251 million years ago, which actually erased 98%. Of all the life forms on Earth.
All right, so that was probably the one he was discussing. Like I said, it was listening to three of them driving around listening to a radio show. So.
Yeah, and that in that case, the oceans actually got so pickled from the introduction of carbon and other things that actually carbonic acid. I always make the mistake of carbonic versus carbolic acid.
Okay.
Became a prime ingredient in the oceans, which really wasn't good for the marine life, and kind of pickled the seas. So that was a bad time.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Richard. We appreciate the call. Tony, where are you calling from?
Hello,
where are you calling from?
Yes, from Cornwall, New York.
Ah, very nice. Well, you're on the line.
Yes, I have a question for the professor. What is the latest calculation for our profit? When it approaches the Earth, I guess 20 years from now, I assume. And the other one is the Pluto probe. What is the timeline?
Pluto?
The probe?
Yes. Well, that the New Horizons mission to Pluto is only now two and a half years from arriving, and we're going to, for the first time, learn about that poor, demoted ex-planet. Very interesting that we launched a probe toward one kind of object, a planet, and it's going to arrive at a different kind of object, that is a dwarf planet.
That's
now, as for Apophis, your other question, the asteroid Apophis will come close on April 13th, 2029, and very close. It'll come as near as that asteroid DA 2012 DA 14 a year ago. Remember, on the same date, February 15th, the same date that Siberian event came over Chelyabinsk. We had that very, very close encounter. Well, this is going to be just as close. It's going to come closer than our geostationary satellites that are all the way up there at 22,300 miles. Closer than that, that's on April 13th, Friday the 13th, by the way, of 2029. Now, that's not going to hit us, but the concern is that it will change the orbit of Apophis. And
next time.
Next time, so that on that same date in 2036, there's a small chance, the latest figures I've seen from NASA are that the chances are 1 in 250,000.
That's still a pretty good chance. Indeed. In the size of the universe, that's pretty good.
Yes, that it could strike us. But the size of it is not, it would be a nasty impact, but it wouldn't be one of those extinction events.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate
my
the
pleasure.
Call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest. George is calling in Massachusetts. Where are you calling from, George?
I'm calling, well, actually, I'm in Whately, Massachusetts right now.
All right. Well, you are on with Bob Berman.
Okay. My question is, if you could comment a little bit, I think they're related questions about the recent events that pushed our understanding of the Big Bang back a few seconds or maybe a major part of a second. And my question really has to do with, what does our understanding now have to say about, I believe it's called the inflationary period of the Big Bang, where my incomplete understanding is that there may have been a period in the expansion where stuff, whatever that means, was moving faster than the speed of light for potentially a very brief period, which explains certain things about our understanding of the universe right now. Could you comment on what that means?
Sure. Well, ever since 1979, when Alan Guth first proposed this inflationary model, he did it for the simple reason that when we look around us, everywhere in the universe, there's a homogeneity in temperature, in galactic structure, that shows that there had to have been a communication or a closeness at a time that allowed future galaxies and galaxy clusters to form, making a universe. It wasn't chaotic. It wasn't scattered. And the best way to explain this happening is if there was an inflationary period, that is right after the Big Bang, that lasted for less than a second, and that was far faster than the speed of light, so that everything was essentially in communication with everything until that inflation began. Now, there were problems with it. For example, what would do that? How can space inflate like that? But, of course, those problems are secondary to the issue of, you know, what the heck was the Big Bang to begin with and what preceded it and what could have caused that. But, you know, putting that aside, since we still have to put that aside, we don't know what preceded the Big Bang or what caused it. The recent evidence has shown a pattern in space that proves that the inflationary, that inflation was real. This doesn't surprise anybody involved in astrophysics, because it had to have been real. What's interesting, though, to me, is that ever since 1998, when we found that the universe is expanding faster and faster, that is, when it was 6 or 7 billion years old, half its present age, instead of slowing down its rate of expansion, thanks to gravity and everything pulling on everything else, the inflation rate started speeding up again. This strongly suggests that the Big Bang is still banging, that whatever it was that produced this is still there, and that all it needed was for space and the universe to become empty enough so that it could gain the upper hand over gravity and start re-exerting itself. And so the thinking now is that this expansion will continue faster and faster and faster, like a kind of miniature Big Bang or a second Big Bang, and nobody knows anything that could stop it. But of course, since, you know, lest we get too depressed over the picture of a universe that gets lonelier and darker and the stars all go out, and there's a few caveats. Since we don't know what started it, we don't know if it'll reverse itself. And maybe,
well, I
maybe
decided that's far enough out, so I don't really have to worry about
that's
that.
That's a good
one,
point.
But,
right, exactly.
You know, there's bigger fish to fry than that one.
Good, thank you. Thank you.
But could I ask one little follow-up question about that then?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that there must have been this period that something, the universe, whatever you want to call it, was moving faster than the speed of light, at least for a very brief period of time. Is there any modification of relativity theory that supports that, or is this a observed fact with no theory to support it?
Well, I would say it's the latter, because we're talking about the properties of space.
There was a
time when we regarded space as real, and among other things we could say about space is that it's the emptiness between objects. But we've known for a long time, for at least five different reasons, that space really has no reality to it, that the gap between objects changes due to factors like your speed. There's no actual size or distance to things, that the universe is fundamentally sizeless, and that instead of picturing it as a very enormous entity that is either finite or infinite, all the recent evidence is pointing toward it maybe likely being infinite.
Okay.
And then thinking of it as large, it's probably best to think of it as sizeless to begin with. So this whatever you want to call it, the fabric of the universe itself between bits of matter is what inflates. Even now, when we say galaxies are rushing away, they're not actually moving. They're just sitting there while the space between them inflates.
Okay.
All right. That's enough of that. We have to take a break. Thank you very much. Zach, I'm going to clear my head. 1-800-348-2551 is the number.
Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. St. Joseph School, Uptown Kingston, an Academy of Arts and Sciences offering pre-K, elementary, and middle school placements for fall 2014. Daily tours of the historic Uptown campus, joyful learning guided by faith. StJosephSchoolKingston.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting the exhibition Of Time and the Mohawk River, featuring artwork depicting the Mohawk River and Erie Canal from the 19th to 21st centuries. ArkellMuseum.org. And the Beechwood Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC. Serving not-for-profits and individual investors, Mary McDonald, Financial Advisor, and Joseph Steiniger, CFP Financial Advisor. TheBeechwoodGroup.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest. It's the astronomy show. It'll blow your mind, people. And the question is, how do you get a scientist to wake up at 9 o'clock in the morning, make him go to a symposium? And you'll be at a symposium.
Yes, at Marist College. That's this Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. I'll be the speaker at 9 o'clock.
You need a wake-up call?
I probably do.
Yeah.
And the topic there will be essentially how our observations alter the universe, whether the act of observing the universe changes it.
Okay. So this would be one of those bring your own lava lamp events and kick back and contemplate the universe. What else you have going on, Bob?
Once every couple of years, we give classes at our observatory and at my home, and this is that time.
So you have an observatory at your home?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
And so that's four Friday nights in May, and people can contact me at SkymanBob.com or SkymanBob@AOL.
Okay, so SkymanBob.com. You can find information and contact information for Mr. Berman. Let's go to Fred in Wininskill. Fred, you're up.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
This is a great show. Always
Thanks.
Love to listen to it.
Appreciate it.
I've heard that the Milky Way or the galaxies, when they spin around the center, they spin more like a record on a record player, as opposed to the revolution of the planets around the sun. The inside ones revolving quicker than the outside ones. And except for right at the center, where I guess the stars kind of really spin up going around the center, if that's true, how does that, why does that work that way?
Well, that's a great question, and it's absolutely true, everything you've just said. And I even liked your allusion to vinyl records, because it just shows we're in the same generation.
Yeah, we're old.
And
that's right.
Just trying to avoid that. Yeah, in the solar system, thanks to gravity being stronger, Mercury whirls around the sun in just 88 days, and poor Pluto takes 248 years, so it's a different speed. But in our galaxy, just as you said, the whole thing spins as if it were a flat disk. It's not exactly accurate to say it, but let's put it this way. The speed of everything is the same. You could go move out from our distance. You can move 40,000 light years further away from the galactic center, or 10,000 light years closer, and you'd get objects moving at essentially the same speed as our sun and Earth move, 140 miles per second. So why? That doesn't make sense. Unless there's about six times more stuff, unseen stuff, exerting a gravitational pull than we can imagine, that maybe the whole galaxy is embedded within a larger invisible structure, like a ship in a bottle, and that we call this unseen gravitationally pulling stuff dark matter, and we still don't know what it is, and there's a chance it doesn't exist. If gravity itself acts differently from the way we've always assumed when it gets to low levels, it's a theory called MOND, M-O-N-D, then dark matter need not exist. But unless that's true, unless gravity is different from the way we think, and it doesn't fall off inversely with the square at all levels
right.
of intensity the way we think, then there is some unseen thing. We've known this since 1933 when Fritz Zwicky first noted this, and that is the only thing that could explain the galaxy rotating the way it does, the way this caller has mentioned.
But you have mentioned in previous shows these Israeli scientists who have said, well, we think that once you reach a distance very far away, if in fact there is such a thing as distance, we'll go back to that conversation, that gravity then has an inverse effect.
Yes.
And so therefore it would obviate the need for dark matter to explain things. But they really don't know what gravity is yet, right?
No, that's another issue. It's mysterious.
All right. So we have no answers. Let's go to Paul in Hillsdale. Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This kind of piggybacks into what that symposium you're talking about, in terms of observing things and changing them. This is a very new agey kind of stuff that I keep on hearing, that since the body is electrical and your mind is energy and electricity, you can then project it and move matter. And they use and they talk about quantum physics as proof, and they talk about that theory that when you observe things on a subatomic level, you can affect them. What do you think about using quantum physics as the reason for this whole theory?
Well, a lot of what you said just now, I wouldn't subscribe to, because I don't think we can look at things. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I don't think we can look at things and levitate them. I've not seen any evidence for it. But this whole business of affecting the observer affecting what's observed, this has a lot of observational or experimental validity starting back in the 1930s, starting with the double slit experiment, which there's no way I can get into this here. If we had television and a chalkboard, maybe I could begin to do it, but I know you've heard of it. And essentially it means that how we make an observation of either matter, like electrons or whole atoms, or bits of light, like photons, how we observe it changes what it is. We could change it from a particle to a wave depending upon what we're looking for and what knowledge we have. I mean, it was bad enough that just the setup of the experiment would change what we saw, but by using entangled particles and just inferring where these objects must be by, for example, observing their entangled twin and gaining information about where they therefore must be. Gaining that information in our minds apparently is enough to physically change the object from being a wave or a particle, and where it leaves what's called its wave function, where the wave function collapses and it goes from just a probability item that could be anything to an actual particle or an actual bit of light in a particular position with particular motion. Now, that's been reproduced so many times that we can't turn away from that anymore, that the act of observing has an effect on the universe. Now, how far you want to go with that, whether
right.
this means that the perception and the cosmos are correlative, whether, again, you talked about a new age kind of thing, or whether there's oneness, I would not take it so far as to say I as an individual can control by my will what's happening. But there does seem to be the mere act of observing. Even John Wheeler, the famed no-nonsense physicist, he just died a year or two ago, he liked to say that no object is a real object until it's an observed object.
Uh-huh.
And that absent observation, the idea of, okay, what's there if nobody's looking, that's deeper. That's not new agey. That's deeper than we used to think.
Well, So the whole idea of putting your thought out there in the universe and having it sort of wishful thinking in a way, it'll come back to you in your request. I mean, that's taking it to the extremes, but that's this whole theory.
Wow. Yeah, and that I couldn't answer. That would be outside my field. That would be more like spiritual or metaphysical or philosophical.
Right, they're saying that the two are tied because of quantum physics.
Well, I'll try that at the slot machines and see if it works.
Right.
That's a good idea. Paul, thank you very much. Let's go to David in Cambridge. David, you're on.
Hi. It sounds like you guys opened a Pandora's box.
You betcha.
Here.
Yep, we sure did.
That's why his eyes be calling.
All right.
So, anyways, and the fellow who preceded me actually kind of brought up some sort of interesting topics, and a lot of stuff went down. With Dr. Vernon Heisenberg in the 1930s, and of course these concepts found their way into the arts, such as the play Our Town, where one of the characters after she dies goes back 20 years in time because as an ectoplasm she's a photon torpedo. So this gets back to Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle, I would suppose. And of course, to fast forward to about 40 years ago, when we were talking about probabilities or improbabilities, people such as Douglas Adams, of course, picked that up as a way of moving the Heart of Gold starship around the galaxy on improbability drive. Wow. So people just go off with this. But originally, I guess Heisenberg opened the can of worms originally with this uncertainty principle, which is, I guess, going to be hit upon in your symposium this Saturday.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm not certain, but...
Well, you should check it out, David. Thank you very much for the call. When is the symposium?
It's 9 in the morning on Saturday at Marist College.
At Marist, okay. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Steve in Steventown, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
My question has to do with the attention that keeps coming up in the press and the public with the notion that humans could one day leave Earth and find a habitable planet elsewhere in the universe, the search for planets that could support life and all that. And if I'm correct, the nearest star to our own solar system is 2 light years away, and the fastest travel humans ever accomplished is 25,000 miles an hour, which would get you there in about 100,000 years.
Yeah, it'll take a while. Yeah.
Yes.
With rest stops, a little more. Yeah.
So I don't even know. I don't know with all the problems we have with our environment on our own planet why the notion of an escape to somewhere else is even entertained.
No, it's actually twice as far as that. It's about 4.25 light years away. But
right.
But it hardly matters. It doesn't change your valid point that who would fund a multi-century mission, and is it ethical to send people into space where they'd get radiation or they'd be away from any possibility of medical care should they develop a tumor or something? And would we really do star travel if it involved years or centuries?
Well, not at our current level of technology, but isn't it interesting to find a planet in the so-called, whatever, Goldilocks zone of a star that might be 15 light years away. One that perhaps, if somebody was there, you could communicate via radio with and not have it take 1,000 years for the radio signal to get there.
That's true. If we could actually do 15 light years away, it would mean that if we said hello, 30 years later, yeah. hey, hi, how are you doing?
And then the starships would arrive soon after. All right, thank you very much. Let's go to Caroline. And where are you calling from, Caroline?
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I love this program. I have two questions, one for myself and one for my daughter who's in school right now. My question would be kind of brief, maybe description on the book Biocentrism and what it means. And then I am going to ask this question for my daughter. She would love to know about downloading of consciousness. And
did
I
did you say the word downloading?
Yes. Like that you can put your, like if consciousness is downloadable, or would it ever be downloadable in terms of like your brain being kind of reduced to a series of waves.
There's a Johnny Depp movie out now pertaining
to
this.
I see. Usually when it gets very catchy when you put a phrase together that involves two kind of concepts like that, downloadable and consciousness.
Sure.
I can see
why
that could... I'll do the first one.
These are 15-year-olds, but they talk about it all the time.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, Biocentrism, two books ago or three books ago for me, that was the only book I co-authored with
loved
Dr.
It.
Rob. Oh, you did. Thank you.
I read it and I loved it, but I still need it explained, unfortunately.
thank you. I mean, it was pretty far out. The idea being that instead of the universe, I'm not telling you this, I'm telling our listeners this, that instead of the life and consciousness popping out of a dead universe, a random universe, we create the universe essentially from life, that there's no part of the universe that's not a part of consciousness or life, and we use various ways of explaining that viewpoint. That was biocentrism. Consciousness is a mystery. So when you say downloadable or not, my old friend Paul Hoffman, who was publisher of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I mentioned that as a kind of name dropping because just to show that he's a smart guy.
Okay.
He always regarded the question of consciousness as the deepest mystery of science. We don't know how consciousness, other than knowing how life began, the idea of awareness and perception and consciousness that we possess, we look around us, we're hearing, we're thinking, we're seeing things. How did that initially arise? And it's such a deep mystery that there aren't even guesses about that. And it's very nature. The more you think about it, the more far out and mysterious it gets.
Yeah.
Well, I loved that book, Biocentrism. I also, another book that really rocked my world when I was younger was a book called, by Julian Jaynes, called The Origin of Consciousness the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, I'm just very interested in it, and I wanted to thank you for,
Well, thanks.
Taking me somewhere else,
I appreciate that. That's very
That's a great
very
way
kind
of putting
of
it, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the
thank
call.
You.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bye.
You definitely do take us somewhere else. Let's go to, is it Jiffy?
Jesse.
Jesse says Jiffy on the sheet. I apologize. Well, you only have just a Jiffy, Jesse, so go ahead.
I had a question about leap years and whether we knew about them before we developed our current calendar, and if our date, April 3rd, 2014, would actually be accurate if that was accounted for.
Well, it's a good question. You know, the whole problem is because the number of times that Earth makes a spin on its axis in a year isn't even. It's 365.2426 days, so that's not even 365.25 exactly. So even if you add an extra day every 4 years, that doesn't quite do it. You're always going to have a little bit left over. So the whole idea of the Gregorian calendar and the reason it improved on the Julian calendar 400 years ago is that it's taking care of that tiny little fraction, and it does so that once every 400 years, and we just had it in the year 2000, instead of the century year actually being a leap year, we skip it. We skip the leap year that time, and we just have it as an ordinary year. And that takes care of that little bit of a fraction. And the penalty for that this century is that instead of the dates of the equinoxes and solstices returning to the 21st, like if you're beyond a certain age, maybe you remember that spring was March 21st.
Yes.
Well, that's finished. It's
so
been March 20th, and it's going to become the 19th, and that's all because of that little calendar tweak.
Okay, well, we have 40 seconds, and I'll tell you this. Support comes from Mohonk Preserve. New Paltz presenting the Rock the Ridge 50-Mile Challenge for runners, walkers, hikers on May 3rd. Sponsored by I Love New York and Ulster County Alive. RockTheRidge50.org for registration. Oblong Books, proud to be presenting partner of the Read Local Red Hook Literary Festival, Saturday, April 12th, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. in Red Hook Village, oblongbooks.com. And Healthy Living Market and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, featuring divine wines at the Wilton Mall with wines from all over the world and weekly tastings, healthylivingmarket.com. Thanks to the great Bob Berman for being here. Thanks to the great Zach Malloy for doing the controls. And our phones were answered by Nelson O'Connor. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. Thank you for listening. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. We'll be talking about cooking for kids.